Welcome back. This is another episode of Queerly High Valley. I'm your host, Robin. I use any pronouns, and I'm super excited to have a guest today, Andy. And we're going to talk a little bit about the topic of queerness and neurodivergent identities. This month is April, which is Autism Acceptance or Awareness Month. So we thought it was a cool time to talk about this topic. So feel free to introduce yourself, Andy, and tell a little bit about yourself to the audience.
Hi, I'm Andy. I use she, they pronouns. I am experimenting with they, she pronouns.
Love
wildly
that.
Different. So I am a low-income single mom. I am the parent to an autistic child. I myself am bipolar, have PTSD, and a traumatic brain injury. I'm also in school full-time for criminal justice and paralegal studies. I would love to be a lawyer someday. I have survived, quite honestly, immeasurable violence, and I always like to point out that I am only here today because of government welfare services. I know taxes suck, but your taxes keep me fed.
Love that. Thank you for sharing, Andy, and I'm super excited to talk about this topic with you. So just jumping right into it, because I know not everybody has like heard of the term neurodivergent. What does the term neurodivergent mean to you?
So I have a silly answer, a serious answer, and kind of like a dictionary answer.
I want all of them.
My silly answer is just brain, no work. If you are neurodivergent and listening, I feel like that's pretty self-explanatory to you. But my more serious answer is I'm going to start with a quote by Temple Grandin, who I like to think of as the autistic cow lady. So she like went to school for some kind of agricultural studies and designed this really fascinating livestock chattel mechanism that basically she figured out that the way that cows' eyeballs work, if they walk in a specific direction in a specific shape, they don't get freaked out by like all of the livestock activities that have to happen to cows. And anyway, she has a quote that's also a TED talk that is, the world needs all kinds of minds, and that I really like that. But yeah, I think everyone's brain does work differently, but when your brain works differently enough to the point of feeling like this world or maybe parts of it weren't built for you, you might be neurodivergent. If you like read a work email and you're like, what is this person talking about? How do I reply to them in like a brain way? You might be neurodivergent.
Love that description. I especially appreciate the ways in which you're kind of engaging with the idea that to diverge means that there is some sort of a norm, and that's super hard to pin down because what's considered like normal does vary like culture to culture, place to place. But I like the idea of like understanding it as like diverging from a norm in a enough of a way that it starts to become, you can feel and sense that like difference, or sometimes it might create barriers for people. Some different identities that I think people, just to help people like, you know, hone in on it, like autistic, it definitely usually is one of the first things people think about with neurodivergent identities, but all different kinds of mental illnesses and disabilities fall under that. ADHD, like you mentioned, PTSD, all sorts of other kinds of, you know, intersections of ways in which people think about the world.
Yeah, like I actually just completed a short-term internship with my university's disability services office. And at our little tabling events, we defined neurodiversity as somewhat of a catch-all term that disability justice advocates have developed to move away from terms like impaired and things like that. So neurodiversity is kind of like various mental illnesses, reading disabilities, things like that. Like basically you process information differently than how you might be expected to.
Yeah, for sure. And I appreciate you naming that. The framing is very purposeful for us to be able to like think of these identities for the things that make society great is that like we all do have different ways in which we think about the world. And so like I appreciate you bringing that disability justice piece into it too. So as a queer and neurodivergent person, what was your process like coming into and understanding yourself in both or a mixture of those identities?
So my gay awakening was simultaneously Jennifer's Body and Total Drama Island. I feel like Jennifer's Body is pretty self-explanatory if you've seen the movie. Total Drama Island was like that Cartoon Network cartoon reality TV show, and it just had so many gay undertones that watching it as a preteen, I was like, that's interesting. I'll think about that later in life.
Do you feel like it's really common to like have an experience of like because we are like so in our own identities, being like, oh, this like must be a normal, you know, everybody kind of experience, and then sharing that with someone and then being like, oh, no, you might fall outside of what is considered the norm in some way. So
No,
I love,
exactly.
yeah, I love the very strangely specific reference. So I did watch that like animated reality TV show on Cartoon Network, and I can definitely see some of the queer undertones. I love that that was a moment for you. And thinking about neurodiversity, how did you come into like understanding yourself as a neurodivergent person? Are there any like similarities with coming into like understanding yourself as a queer person?
Think so. My like process of coming into my neurodivergent identity was much longer and a little rockier. So it took me a really long time to come to terms with being bipolar. One, because it took a lot of time to find a medication that worked for me to like manage the adverse aspects of that mental illness, but also because a lot of readings like by and about bipolar people that are suggested to you know, when you're in the hospital or the doctor's office or something, they're basically like, oh my God, I drained my bank account, I cheated on my spouse, and I am banned from several localities. And I was like, that really doesn't sound like me. And no one ever explained to me that like the mania of bipolar doesn't have to be this big, dramatic, maybe you did something illegal experience. So it just took me a long time to understand what it means to be bipolar. Interestingly enough, the medication that does actually work for me is often used to quote unquote treat extreme agitation in the autistic population. So there's like a whole separate conversation about self-diagnosing as autistic, but there's a very high comorbidity between bipolar and autism in AFAB people. And I score like a 126 on the RADS test every time I take it online. So I'm just gonna go ahead and say probably.
And it's so interesting because a lot of times when we're like talking about mental health diagnoses, a lot of them are based on like observable or like communicable traits, like we can express that we experience things. And so they're not exactly the same as, like, I don't know, if someone were to diagnose you with a broken arm, they would be like, there is clearly a broken arm. And so I'm often curious about like the ways in which these diagnoses are like trying to put language to like very nuanced and complicated like ways in which we're interacting with the world. So that is all to say, I totally agree. I feel like people can self-identify as autistic. And a lot of people who are marginalized or assigned female at birth, like, might not always resonate with a lot of the ways in which autistic folks are described in even like some of the literature, though I do think that like the whole field of psychology is improving with diagnosis and stuff. I should have also mentioned that I'm an autistic person. And I also have OCD. So I come into this conversation via that way, but I realized as I was talking, because I enjoy talking to you, Andy, that I was like, yes, listeners should have that context as well. I feel like we're kind of getting close to this conversation, but I feel like there's a lot of like in community conversation about the connection between neurodivergence and LGBTQ plus identities. What do you think we can learn from the connection between these identities? Because we've already kind of started dipping into talking about that.
So, in my personal experience, I think because of the whole brain no work aspect of neurodiversity, maybe neurodiverse people are a lot more likely to experiment or be open to experimenting with like their gender, sexual, and relationship identities because there's already that aspect of their life where maybe they feel like I don't fit in or I don't belong here. So maybe I'll try out a different name or a different pronoun or date someone of like a different gender than I'm expected to.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I also think it makes me curious about like how many more people would maybe consider themselves part of a queer umbrella if there wasn't the pressure of like societal expectations. Because I do think like neurodivergent folks do have this tendency of like maybe questioning or pushing back against societal expectations in a way that our like non-neurodivergent peers might not in the same way. This is all like leading to my thesis that many more people are bisexual than they are willing to admit. Just because, I mean, my partner always says it is like extremes in nature are not super common. That's not to say that people who say that they're straight are not straight, or people who are only attracted to one gender are not being truthful because that's their experience. But I do think that there are a lot more bisexual people out there than probably know. And maybe our neurodivergent folks are maybe tapping into that a little bit. And I think that it is very interesting because I don't always see it talked about in the queer community frequently, but a lot of the spaces that I know that I'm part of for LGBTQ plus people do feel like materially like I feel like there's a lot of neurodivergent people here. Have you experienced that too?
Oh, for sure. Like one of the questions that you pre-sent to me was about like the queer and neurodivergent spaces. And I frequently go to the Eastern PA trans equity group called Radiant, which is for queer neurodiverse people. And oftentimes in that little like social segment before we break off into our support groups, someone will be going to like the trans mask or the trans femme or the non-binary group, and we'll have a conversation where I'm just kind of like, this is so autistic coded, like you just info dumped your special interest on me, and I love that.
Yeah, for sure. I feel that a lot of times too. And it always fascinates me because a lot of people aren't always like aware that they might fall into that category. And that makes me even more curious about the ways in which, like we talked about a little bit earlier, like some of the ways media might portray an autistic person or a person with bipolar. In you describing that, I definitely realized that really extreme kind of like I bought a sports car and I left my wife like situation does seem to be like in broader media, what is the most common things that I've seen associated with bipolar? It does make me think about the ways in which some of these representations make people maybe less likely to seek out more information about themselves or see themselves reflected in that specific neurodivergent category.
Yeah, and you know what really, really made the bipolar identity click for me is I had a clinician explain to me that being bipolar is less about the way you act and more about the way it makes you feel and function. And I was like, oh, that makes sense because I've had those very extreme highs and very extreme lows, but I tend to internalize them just as the type of person I am. So I'd have to be like really, really manic to go drain my bank account or do something. I guess more on the extreme end of those things, like more visible to other people.
I think that that explanation is helpful for a lot of different neurodiversities, that kind of being more about like the wiring and the things that you experience. Well, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back with more Queer Lehigh Valley. I'm here with Andy and I'm your host, Robin, and we'll be back in a sec.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
Hello and welcome back to Queerly High Valley. I'm your host Robin. I'm here with Andy, talking about all things queerness and neurodiversity during Autism Acceptance and Awareness Month. So we already started talking about this a little bit before the break, but where do you find queer and neurodivergent community in the Lehigh Valley specifically? You mentioned Radiant a little bit, but are there other spaces? And maybe if you want to tell folks a little bit more about what Radiant is.
Yeah, I mean, Radiant is a support group for queer and neurodivergent people. They do a really great job hosting it. It's like segmented. You get fidget toys most of the time. It's fantastic if you want to come out for a good time. I'm also a really big fan of PATH, which is a slightly newer organization that stands for People with Alternative Thinking and Healing. That's, I think, more on the mental illness side of neurodivergency, but it's basically a peer-led anti-carceral group. They meet around 7:30 at the Palmer Recovery Center in Easton on Thursday nights. They're really fantastic. It's basically like a share a little bit and people can give feedback, but there's a very strict rule about not giving unsolicited advice. I don't currently go to their group meetings very frequently, but I do run their resource request form. With my autistic son, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Autism Society at the Lehigh Valley runs a lot of great children's play groups, parent support groups for parents of autistic children, but I'm sure they'd be very welcoming if you had a child of some other neurodiverse identity.
Cool. I super appreciate you like sharing some of those connections. I wasn't totally aware of that group out of the Palmer Center, so that's super honestly helpful for me to know too. I feel like sometimes we like gather in like spaces that not everybody knows about, so we should always share whatever ever possible. I do feel like you are like a resource guru, Andy, so I appreciate the ways in which you help connect people to stuff.
I have been an unpaid social worker at many a job, or not unpaid. I've been like an unlicensed social worker who should be paid more for doing unlicensed social work at many jobs.
I feel like a lot of folks who deal with a lot of different intersections of identities, abilities, and stuff often end up in a place like that. So we thank you for your service. So what are some supports or opportunities you think might be good for like strengthening queer and neurodivergent community in the Lehigh Valley?
I think because there is just generally that overlap of queer and neurodivergent identity, a lot of queer spaces can be better about accessibility needs, and a lot of neurodiverse spaces can be more queer affirming. And that can be as simple as, you know, making sure the physical space is accessible to folks, offering closed captioning if someone requests, finding like a sign language interpreter. In the more neurodiverse spaces, you can use pronouns as an intro if people want to share. You can, you know, not ask invasive questions about gender and sexuality, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I love those like basic overview kind of like techniques, because they definitely do make a huge difference. And I definitely feel like for myself as a queer and autistic person that I do feel like sometimes queer spaces don't like meet my needs as a disabled person. And then sometimes disability spaces don't meet my needs as like a queer person. I don't know if you've encountered this, but I've definitely experienced a lot of times disability focused spaces. Like there's sometimes like an assumption that like, I don't know, neurodivergent people like can't be queer or something like that. At least I've encountered that in some of like different peer support programs I've been part of. People will say stuff like, oh, like our client like thinks that she's a lesbian. And it's like, well, I have news. If she thinks she's a lesbian, she's a lesbian. Like, so I've encountered a lot of, I mean, it's like ableism coupled with homophobia.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of ties into the experience that I know a lot of adults with autism experience, where it's that kind of like belittling of like, oh, well, you're autistic, so you couldn't possibly know about this. And it's like, no, like autistic adults do know what sex is for the most part. And it's okay for them to have it if they understand, you know, consent and safety practices and all that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there is some very early research about things like STDs in adult autistic folks being oftentimes higher prevalences. And I think that that is definitely probably related to like a lack of sexual health information that's given to a lot of neurodivergent people, because there's kind of like this belief, especially with folks with different disabilities, like intellectual or developmental disabilities, a lot of times there's like some kind of assumption like the assumption that people wouldn't be able to have a sexual relationship or a romantic relationship or stuff like that. I do feel like things are maybe shifting a little bit, but I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I've definitely struggled a little bit in like disability advocacy in the Lehigh Valley. I feel like there's definitely people doing really cool stuff, but there seems to be like not as much like general awareness around disability as like also a political identity, and like an understanding of ableism as like, part of the bad systems that hurt everybody.
So I have two experiences that kind of tap into that. One, when I was in high school, I went to Harrisburg with my local state rep to do like a little tour of the Capitol, and he took us to some of the I forget what they're called. I don't know if it's like a caucus or a working group or a committee, but he took us to one of those meetings, and there was a group of disabled people having a die-in at one of the Medicare hearings, and they were like, if you take our insurance away, we will literally die. And that was the first time I've seen something about that. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. And then, very similar, there was a die-in. I think it was led by Lehigh Valley Democrats because they do the Mondays with McKenzie where they go yell at Ryan McKenzie's office. So they had like they made the little tombstone posters and stuff and just laid on the sidewalk in front of his office building. And I think that's something a lot of people forget, is that disability is one of the only identities that you can come into throughout your life. Because like, if you're like LGBT, you've always been that, even if you didn't recognize it for a really long time. But like, you can lose your vision, your ability to walk, develop age-related health issues. So like, anybody can become disabled. Like, you are one health crisis or catastrophic incident away from becoming disabled. So like, while advocating for disabled people shouldn't be stemming from a purely selfish standpoint, you are protecting yourself in the long run, because at some point, most people get old enough that they struggle to walk at the very least, where their eyesight starts to go.
Sure. I really appreciate you naming that, because I do think that people don't always like put that into perspective also, because it is true that a lot of people will at some point in our lives like experience disability, whether it's now or down the line. And making things more accessible for folks generally makes them more accessible for everybody. Along those lines, you already kind of noted some like tips or stuff for organizations becoming more inclusive. Are there any other kinds of practices that like you specifically wish that you would see in more spaces to make them more inclusive, either for like yourself or other neurodivergent identities?
I really wish more spaces knew how to just like smoothly move through a disruption. Like, if someone all of a sudden has to take care of their insulin or maybe has Tourette's and has those like verbal stims that can feel like a disruption, like, you don't have to make a big deal about it, but you also don't have to purposefully ignore it. Like, you can acknowledge that it happened, be like, hey, do you want us to pause or wait? Depending on the person's answer, you can give some space or a break, or you can just kind of like move on past it. Like, you don't have to ogle the disabled person when they're dealing with something.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. That's really interesting. I don't feel like I've ever heard that like totally named so directly, but I really appreciate it because I definitely have experienced that where people kind of either have like a panicked freaking out about something that's kind of normal for a disabled person, or like just completely ignoring whatever that person is experiencing. I really do think that like normalizing the different ways in which we move, talk, emote, make noises, is a really great way to make a space feel a little bit more inclusive. Because I do think that some of those, like, especially like the impulse to like just completely ignore somebody, can kind of maybe make people feel invisible, and also like doesn't do a lot towards normalizing that we're all gonna, exist differently in spaces. Whenever I can, I usually try to like tell people at the beginning of an event, like, hey, everybody's gonna like respond to information, emotions, feelings differently, and like, take care of what you need to do in the best way, and we'll, give you respect space if you want it, or, whatever would make you feel comfortable. So I definitely appreciate that. I know, like, for myself, I definitely appreciate like knowing like the format of a thing that I'm going into, because sometimes I'll go to a space, and especially if it's kind of like a social-based space, and I'll be like, what do people do here? Which sounds silly. Sometimes I feel like being neurodivergent for me makes me feel like an extraterrestrial who's like landed on a space in which I'm like, what do these people do here?
I mean, I can relate to that as a parent who's raising an autistic child. Like, if he's going to a new space or a new event, I will often email like the contact for that event and be like, hey, just requesting for like disability accessibility purposes, what are the layouts and expectations and process of this space? And I don't go through the effort of making an entire crafted like social storyboard for my child. I kind of just verbally talk with him about like, okay, like when we're here, there's going to be this, that, and the third, and the expectations are ABC. If this happens, then we'll do that, just so he's kind of prepared for what we're walking into.
That's really great. I think that that is probably super helpful for him. I feel like I would have appreciated that as a kid. I was a little bit all over the place. Cool. So the question that I want to end us on is, do you have any like queer or neurodivergent writers or artists that have resonated with you lately? I ask this because that's often like how I connect to or relate to topics, is I'm like using art or media or books to kind of like find my way into them.
Yeah, I've recently dove back into Ocean Vuong's writing. He is primarily a poet who has a few novels. I'm actually hosting a book club centered on Night Sky with Exit Wounds, which is a collection of poetry he wrote. I think he is such a beautiful writer. Like, his mastery of words is incredible. I don't know if he's ever identified as neurodivergent, but he talks so deeply about trauma that I'm kind of like, dude, you have PTSD. Like, you have to have PTSD after all of that. But I think his neurodiversity really comes out in the way that he uses words in such an unexpected nature.
I also love Ocean Vuong's writing, especially the book that you're doing a discussion on. And I've never thought about him in the context of neurodiversity, but that like makes so much sense. And I don't always think that someone needs to identify as like specifically neurodivergent for the media to like resonate with you. I know for myself, like I've always written and loved poetry, and I think it's partially because like poetry allows a lot of space for holding complicated feelings or emotions, or like I know for myself, I appreciate when the words or the narrative of the poem kind of dips into something surreal or strange or like evocative, because it does help capture some of those experiences of being neurodivergent. So I definitely appreciate that framing, because I think that that I will approach the book a little bit differently next time.
Yeah, which he is, to my knowledge, an out gay man. He talks a lot about his gay identity in his poetry, so he does hit that base very directly. But I, at least me as a neurodivergent person who lives with a lot of trauma, I'm like, he sees me even though he doesn't know me. Like, I feel so held when I read his poetry. It's one of the only works of literature that can make me cry. So that means a lot to me because, like, my medication evens me out so well that sometimes I'm like, I should be crying and I want to cry, but I cannot cry. So I'll like read something that's very jarring and heartbreaking to get that like catharsis out of my system.
That's so funny, 'cause I have the same experience, but it's because I'm on testosterone. And it is true that it does like I don't know, it stops you from crying a little bit. Cool. Well, this was a really wonderful discussion, and I super appreciate like everything that you shared, and for helping share a little bit with the audience about queerness and neurodiversity. This has been Queerly High Valley here at WDIY. I was your host, Robin, and we were here with Andi today. So thank you so much, and we'll catch you on the next one.